different tonight. Last week we did a big survey, right? We went all over the place looking at Herod and exploring him. Thanks for the water, by the way, Pam. And exploring him. Oh, it's delicious. And tonight we're going to do something a little different. We're going to look just at one story and the place where that took place, and see how that that reveals, or see what that reveals to us about Jesus. And the story we're looking at today takes place in Matthew chapter 16 and in Mark chapter 8. But we're going to focus on the Matthew chapter 16 portion of it. Most people, most scholars agree that the Gospels, that Mark was written first, and that Matthew was based upon what took place in Mark, right? So when you read Matthew, it follows a similar storyline to Mark, but what you see in Matthew is that the stories in Mark are oftentimes amplified, right? And more details are included. And so we're going to see that tonight, that in Matthew chapter 16, it's a fair bit more amplified than Mark chapter 8. So we're going to read from Matthew chapter 16. And anytime you have questions tonight, go for it. I'm gonna do my best not to preach, but to teach. And so that means for me anyways that it's fair game for any questions. So just put up your hand and interrupt, and I'll try and clarify as we go along. So we start in Matthew chapter 16, verse 13. It says this: "When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do the people say the Son of Man is?'" Okay, so here's your first question. What do you know about Caesarea Philippi? You know anything about Caesarea Philippi? Not. It only comes up once in the Bible, and there's not really, that's the amount of detail that's given on Caesarea Philippi. So unless you've studied in Caesarea Philippi, you're not going to know a lot about Caesarea Philippi. It's a bit of a trick question. Okay, so let's go to Caesarea Philippi and see a little bit of what we can discover about it. It is located 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Matthew chapter 4 records that when Jesus, you know, kind of became a man and commenced his ministry, he moved from Nazareth across the Capernaum, and he made this his home. For Jesus' entire ministry years, which is almost the bulk of the Gospels from Matthew 4 on, and equivalent in the other chapter, in the other Gospels, Jesus is living in Capernaum, and except for the odd side trip, and at the end when he comes down to Jerusalem, which is in here, everything takes place in Capernaum. Capernaum, what's special it is, it has a couple of sister cities, Bethsaida and Chorazin, and they called this the Orthodox Triangle. Okay, so this is where the real Jew of Jews lived, in this area here. There would have been some real Jew of Jews in Jerusalem, but Jerusalem, you know, as it is today, at that time was a very secular city, and the high priest in Jesus' day, the whole temple system was all corrupt because of what we learned last week, because of Herod in main part, right? So a lot of the key Jews lived in this area here. But Jesus traveled up to Caesarea Philippi. He went 25 miles with his disciples up to this area, and it would have been at least a couple days' walks. It was 1,700 feet rise in elevation. And so anytime you see something like that happening, you know, you stop and ask the question, why did he go there? And it was so important for him to travel 25 miles, take 2 days with his disciples to make his way up to Caesarea Philippi. And oftentimes, when those questions grab you, if you take time to mine into them, it's there that the stories of the gospel really come to life, and they make way more sense. The rest of this story is a story that is very familiar to everybody in this room, I can guarantee it. But what you'll see unfold after we read Caesarea Philippi is that story makes so much more sense. So, in Old Testament times, this area, Caesarea Philippi, was known as Baal Gad or Baal Hermon. Mount Hermon, which is the tallest mountain in Israel, is up just right around the area of Caesarea Philippi. But at the time in the Old Testament, it was known as Baal Gad. And this area was known as this because it was the area dedicated to the worship of Baal. Hi, guys. Welcome. Come in, please. We're just starting. So you haven't missed much. We're looking at Caesarea Philippi tonight. It's 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus has traveled here, and we're just starting to figure out why did he travel here, okay? So, good stuff. Glad you're here. So, it's known as Baal Gad, and the reason why it's known as Baal Gad in the Old Testament times is because Baal worship was taking place in this particular area. And so we know then right from the very beginning, you know, this is an area of a place that's dedicated to the worship of foreign gods. Now, in 325, this fellow named Alexander the Great comes barreling through basically all the known world, fantastic military commander, takes over all sorts of areas, including the bulk of Israel, and one of the areas he takes over is Baal Gad. Alexander the Great is a Greek, and so he brings with him all the pantheon of Greek gods and understanding of Greek worship. And it's not very long after Alexander then takes over the place that the people in Baal Gad begin to worship this god named Pan. So if those of you that remember your Greek mythology and Greek history, they start worshiping Pan in this area. And as a result, the city changes its name from Baal Gad, it changes its name to Panias. And that's really what it becomes known as for the rest of its history. Even today, the Arabs live there, and so they don't call it Panias, they call it Banias. But it's known by the same term. In Jesus' time, it was called Caesarea Philippi. I'll say why in a moment, but that was just the official term for it. Most people referred to it as Panias, so I'll use that term back and forth tonight. Now, when Jesus comes on the scene, or just before Jesus comes on the scene, Herod the Great, we saw him last week, in this particular area, he establishes a temple to Augustus. You know, all the Roman emperors and that kind of stuff, they were considered to be deity, and so in honor of him, Herod establishes this temple, and so you see this kind of pluralistic nature begin to entrench itself even more in the area. So you've got the worship of Pan, you've got the worship of Baal, and now you've got the worship of Augustus taking place in this area. Yes, you can. No, this is a different one. Okay, so this is that's Caesarea Maritima. We saw it last week, and it's on the Mediterranean. This is not on the Mediterranean. Yeah, they are both Caesarea. This one's Caesarea Philippi. This is where we are. This is Caesarea Maritima. We saw it last week. Okay, different place altogether. All right. Yeah. Okay, so in Jesus' time, Herod the Great dies. He dies in 4 BC. Jesus is about 2 years old when Herod the Great dies. And the nation of Israel is divided, or the kingdom of Israel is divided into three territories between three of his sons. Now this is important for those of you that are reading through your Bible and you're wondering who's who and whatever. So you can stick with this and it will give you a little bit more information. In the south, in Judea, down in this area here, it was ruled by his one son named Archelaus. And he was a terrible ruler. He was eventually deposed by Rome. In the middle section, we have Herod Antipas. When you read about him, he's also called Herod the Tetrarch, right? And he ruled in this area, Galilee and Perea. He was a bumbling buffoon. And many of Jesus' comments about Herod Antipas, or Herod the Tetrarch, Jesus is actually making fun of him. Okay, he's using things of the day that make fun of him. We won't get into it. But Herod Antipas, this guy in here, was the guy that killed John the Baptist. He's the guy that tried Jesus. Okay, so this was Herod Antipas. Now up in this area here, where Caesarea Philippi is, the one son Philip was the ruler up here. He ruled above the Sea of Galilee and to the east. And he was an effective ruler, the best of Herod's sons. He ruled for 50 years. When given this territory, he said, you know, Panias is beautiful, I love it, you'll see why in a moment, it is beautiful territory. And so he decided, I'm going to make this my capital. So he makes it his capital city, changes the name to Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea in honor of Caesar of Tiberias, and Philippi in honor of himself, and he calls it Caesarea Philippi. It becomes the region capital. He builds his palace here. It's a beautiful city that he's got going on here, and it's also headquarters to a number of Roman legions that are in this particular area. Okay, so this was the city. Now, this is who was ruling the city. Now, when Herod Philip was ruling this area, the city itself was dominated by this scene here. And this was a key area of Caesarea Philippi. The city itself was located up on top of this quite large rock or quite large bluff. But these two areas down here, again, this was where all the Pan worship took place. This is the grotto, and this is kind of the main foundation. I'll show you other pictures of it in a second. Okay, so I want to take a moment to explain these two things here for a second. First of all, we'll look at the grotto. The Jordan River, which is like the main river in Israel, right? Everything revolves around the Jordan River. the Jordan River in the north is formed by three underground springs. They come from Mount Hermon. They all eventually make their way into this one Jordan River. One of the underground springs, or one of the tributaries, starts in Caesarea Philippi. And you can see where it started was in the base of this grotto here. In Jesus' day, the water bubbled out of here and made its way down this channel here that you see. In fact, they built this channel in order to contain the water so that they could build their temple complexes around it. But in 325 B.C., or 325 A.D., a huge earthquake. Israel's kind of prone to earthquakes, and a huge earthquake rips its way through the land, and it redirects its flow, so the gurgling and bubbling of that spring no longer happens today. But in Jesus' day, that was a big gurgling spring, and that's important in a moment that you'll see that. Josephus, this guy we met last week, he was a historian of the day. He commented this. So this is why one of the reasons why we know that this thing was a spring bubbling with water. At the base of the cliff is an opening into an overgrown cavern. Within this, plunging down to an immeasurable depth. Josephus was kind of given to exaggeration. You'll see this here. Plunging down to an immeasurable depth is a yawning chasm enclosing a volume of water, the bottom of which no sounding line has been found long enough to reach. So they probably didn't get a long enough rope, in other words. And outside, from beneath the cavern, well up the springs from which the Jordan takes its rise. Okay. Now, it was at the bottom of this grotto here that everybody in Panias, Caesarea Philippi, felt that Pan chose to live. Right? Down at the bottom of this thing. And so they would throw their sacrifices, not human sacrifices, animal sacrifices, food sacrifices, those kind of things. They would throw them down into the water in honor of Pan. They believed that he lived in this location for a really simple reason. And I've talked about this before, so for some of you this is old news. But for those of you that's unfamiliar with, this will be interesting to you, I think. They believed he lived in this particular area because in the ancient world, pagan worship generally existed on or around or near water. And the reason why it existed near water was because in that particular time, they felt that water, bodies of water, was the place of the abyss. It was the place of ghosts and spirits and all the underworld and the creatures of their superstition, right? So, or maybe not superstition, demonic realm or whatever. Now, probably where this came from or this idea came from was a pretty logical thing. You know, anytime their relatives or their friends headed out into the Mediterranean or the Galilee, it seemed that they were always getting shipwrecked and killed, right? And so it kind of began to be believed that, well, the reason why they're getting shipwrecked is because the ghouls and everything out there are stirring up the water and causing the ships to be destroyed. And, you know, the Mediterranean around Israel and the Galilee are both very volatile, tumultuous bodies of water. There is always ships going down. I mean, think about the Gospels. How many times is Jesus out in the water with his buddies and the ships in the water wells up on Galilee, right? In fact, Galilee's a real small lake, but when I was there, the Israelite that we were with said that in the center of the Sea of Galilee, because of the winds, you can get swells in the middle of Galilee that are 14 feet high, right? So it is pretty crazy lake. Mediterranean, even worse. Mediterranean is a crazy body of water around Israel. So people are dying out there, and they naturally seem, well, the reason why people are dying out there is because the ghouls live in the water, right? And even today, just as an aside, even today, Israelite people they're not really interested in living near the water. The Israelite that we were with, the guy's name is Boaz, and Boaz said to us, you know, that Israel people, they're desert people. They're not interested in the water. So here's a couple of scenes around Galilee. Now, they're not interested in the water for different reasons today than reasons back then, right? But here's a couple of scenes around Galilee to give you an idea. Beautiful lake. I wish the weather was better to get a picture. There's one in the bottom that's nice, but you see, this is up in the north, farmland. Galilee is bordering right along here. I wish you can't see it, but it's bordering right along here. This is the Mount of Beatitudes, taken from the Mount of Beatitudes, where Jesus gave his famous Sermon on the Mount. See out in here, hardly anything. You can see a little bit of a white blotch here. That's Tiberias. That's the largest city on the Sea of Galilee. Not much. And this is down in the south of Galilee in a place called Susita, where Jesus kicked out the demons out of the demoniac. Remember that one? And then sent them into the pigs, and they went running down into the water. This is it. It's gorgeous. Beautiful. But hardly any development around the water. They're really interested in being near the water And in the Mediterranean, it's the same deal along the Mediterranean. And around Tel Aviv, there is some development, but on other sides of it, not so much. So, that's what their thoughts about water. Now, as an aside, it's interesting then when you understand that about water, when you read through the Bible, how many things take place in and around water. Right? Well, what's God communicating this? I mean, think about Genesis chapter 1, right? The opening scene, what's taking place? He creates, and the earth is a vast expanse of water. And what does it say? The Spirit is hovering over the water. And his first act with his breath is to speak. And it says that the water is parted or divided and land comes up in its place. Right? What's it communicating there? That God, the Spirit, has power over the spirit realm. What's Israelites' most famous miracle? Parting of the Red Sea, right? Parting the Red Sea, what's communicating there? God saying, don't be afraid. I have power over all things. Right? So this was the reason why they felt Pan lived in the bottom of this cave, because it was a place of water, and it was natural that, well, obviously, deep cave, that's where Pan lives, must live down in there. There's another reason, I'll come to it in a second. The next thing is the rock, which is where most of the worship took place. It's 250 feet long, so not huge, but significant nonetheless. And in Jesus' day, when Jesus would have visited here, there's records of there being a large statue of Pan here on this platform that's long since been gone. But they would worship Pan up in this area here. So, oh yeah, further, the other thing about it, here's a picture of what it looked like in Jesus' day. They know that this is what it looked like because they found coins with this image stamped on it. So they've got a sense of this is what the area would have looked like in these times, all these temples set up beneath these bluffs. And cut into the rock in these areas here are these niches still today. And they're inscribed with, three of them with honors to the god, Pan. So this is what Caesarea Philippi would have looked like when Jesus was entering into the scene here for this story as one trip up here. Now, okay, next question. Who's Pan? You dig back. Anybody know anything? You remember from high school history? Anybody remember anything about Pan?
He had a flute.
He had a flute.
And he drew people.
Yes.
He put them into a state.
Yes. Yes. He had power with his flute.
And it was sexual.
Ah, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
In the woods.
He lived in the woods. Yeah. Okay, you're getting good. Wow, Pam, very good. Somebody's son. Yeah, he was someone's son.
Well,
yeah. Anyone know else? Anything else about Pan?
Part his bottom was goat.
Ah, goat.
Top was a hairy guy.
Man.
Did he have horns?
He had horns.
Like a goat.
Are basically our modern rendering of the devil that we have is based upon Pan. Pan, the Pan god, which doesn't necessarily apply because that wasn't around in Jesus' day, but whatever, interesting for us today. So Pan, here he is here. He's on the left. He's teaching his buddy Daphnis how to play the Pan flute. And with Pan flute, he would instill panic in people, right? Where these words come from. Pan's the guy on the left. And Pan was believed to have been a shepherd. Okay, he lived out in the woods, and he was the tamer of rustic music. He lived in music. He was the mountain wilds. And his name was derived from the Greek paon, which means to pasture or to shepherd. Now, I'm not going to get too much into this, but in a little bit in the story when we read of the story of Jesus, clearly, even though Pan's name doesn't come up, clearly there's a battle going on in this story between Jesus and between Pan. For the reader at that time, it didn't need to be said. They understood what Caesarea Philippi is about. But for us, we're learning, okay, Pan was around back then. Clearly, there's a battle going on between Jesus and Pan in this passage that we're looking at. Isn't it interesting, then, that Pan is a shepherd?
Yeah.
And Jesus is also a shepherd. Right? But Jesus calls himself the good shepherd.
Yeah.
Pan was not a good shepherd. Sure. You can tell by the picture here that Pan was not the the most handsome of individuals. In fact, the story goes, the legend, the myth about Pan is that when his mother gave birth to him, she saw him and she was so scared that she ran away screaming, right? Because he was so ugly. And that was kind of the trajectory of Pan's life as the myth went along, that everyone that saw him was terrified by how horrible he looked. And so as a result of this, Pan was often in a bad mood. And because Pan was in a bad mood, he liked to spend a lot of time hanging out in caves. And hence another reason why they felt that Pan would have dwelt at the bottom of the grotto. We've got water there, and it's a deep cave. Clearly the place of Pan. This is where Pan would be, and so we'll worship Pan in this location. Now, while his chief occupation in life was to pasture or to shepherd, what Pan was best known for was his sexual prowess. Even though he was ugly, he had power over the nymphs, and he was often seen having sex with the nymphs. And he was, in most of his depictions, and I've saved you from these, most of his depictions of Pan is seen with an erect penis. Okay. And, yeah, you weren't expecting that, were you, to come out tonight? Okay, but we're all adults here. It gets better, because at this big statue I'll leave my occult pictures in it for a moment. Okay, at the statues of Pan that was on the temple there, which is no longer, history records the other thing about that particular statue was that it had an enormous erect penis that they would detach from the statue, and as a part of their rituals, right, they would parade it around the Temple Mount, glorifying Pan and all of his sexual prowess. Pan was a sexual god. That was his main deal. He was a god of fertility. And even today, the Wiccans, I downloaded this picture, it's one of the more safe ones that I found, but even today, the Wiccans, they worship Pan as a part of their gods that they worship, and he is the god of virility and sexuality for them as well. You may have seen this symbol before in various locations, the circle with the half moon above it. This is the Pan circle, his horns represented there. So if you've ever looked and seen Wiccan things around, when you see that symbol, you know this is dedicated to Pan. Well, I don't know. It could be. Well, in ancient times, anyway, to carry on with this, in ancient times, these fertility gods and sexuality gods were seen not so much about sex, but actually what they really represented was they represented abundance. Okay, so they represented fruit, they represented life, all those things, right? So people then would come and they would worship these fertility gods, Pan being one of them, with the hopes of enticing him to provide them with fertility in whatever way they needed it, right? So be it that they're hoping to entice him to give them children, or to give them grain, or to give them rain, all the things of fertility, right? So they would come to people like Pan, they would worship gods like Pan in the intent of him giving them what they needed in life. But the way that they enticed gods like Pan into giving them what they need was through this practice that we call sympathetic magic. And basically what sympathetic magic was that they would enact for the god what they expected him to do for them. So in the case of a fertility god, they want this god to give them fertility in all of its various forms. And what that means then was that they had a lot of sex. And they had a lot of sex on this open rock. This rock was basically one ongoing public orgy. They were always having sex out here, temple prostitution, all sorts of various forms. And history also records that the other thing that was going on in this place was a fair bit of bestiality, particularly with goats. So this is a creepy, creepy place, at least by our standards, but at their standards, that was the way that they enticed Pan to think, okay, well, they're being fertile for me, so I'll be fertile for them. I'll give them what they need. And you can see here as well, then, one of the reasons why probably the Roman soldiers decided that they wanted to spend a lot of time in this particular area, right? Because there's a lot of good sex going on, and soldiers are into that sort of thing. So So this was Caesarea Philippi. So sum it up here. 25 miles, Jesus loads up his disciples, right? And remember these disciples generally were chosen when they were teenagers. So Jesus chooses these gang of disciples. They follow him around. By this point, they've been with him for a couple of years. He loads up the disciples. They head out of the Orthodox Triangle, and they begin to make their way up the 25 miles, 1,700 feet, to Caesarea Philippi. Now, we can be sure that it would have been really unusual for them to be seeing any Jewish rabbis in this area. There wouldn't have been a lot of rabbis strolling around Caesarea Philippi. He would have been an odd sight. And the reason why is because it would have made them unclean. Rabbis can't go in this kind of stuff. It makes you ceremonial unclean. But Jesus goes anyways, and he walks 25 miles. It's definitely the longest trip recorded that Jesus took. He may have taken longer, but none are recorded. And he makes his way all the way to Caesarea Philippi, the land of the Gentiles, right? The land of Pan, the land of Augustus and all their temples, the land of Roman soldiers on R&R, the land of sympathetic magic, the land of temple prostitution, the land of bestiality. He makes his way up into this area here. And I want you to imagine then that, I think this is another slide here. Right. Okay, yeah. I want you to see that picture there. So I want you to imagine then that a similar place to this exists today. It doesn't, right? Not in the West anyways. Nothing like Pan really exists here. And yet, it exists everywhere, and even maybe to a greater degree, just behind closed doors, right? But I want you to imagine that a place like this existed today. Now, I am, you know, a rabbi-like in your midst, if you will. I'm a pastor here. I'm intended to be a spiritual leader in this community, right? What if I told you that this place existed, and one weekend I was going to load up some of the church mates, and we were going to go on a little retreat up to Caesarea Philippi? Now, you might have a little concern, eh? What? And I don't think that's a great place for you to be going. Well, what good is it there for you? And so you can imagine even more so how much the Orthodox Jews would have thought, like, what is he doing? And why on earth would you go to Caesarea Philippi? And that's a good question. Why did he go here? What's going on? Why did he want to be here in Caesarea Philippi? Well, let's read a little more of the story together. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do the people say that the Son of Man is?" They replied. Now, just as a point of interest, this area here, the rock, would have been the region of Caesarea Philippi, because the city was actually up on top of the hill. So it's quite potential that Jesus was in eye shot of this location. I kind of doubt that he made it very close to it. I think Jesus was like, you know, we get the idea. That's kind of probably my hunch on it. But nonetheless, probably somewhere within this vicinity, he asked this question, "Who do the people say that the Son of Man is?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "Well, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he's warned his disciples, to not tell anyone that he was the Christ. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in His Father's glory with His angels, and then He will reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Okay. Let's break for a cup of coffee. Grab a cup of coffee and a date square or something like that, and then we'll come back and we'll dig into the story based upon what we just learned about Caesarea Philippi. Huh? All right. Let's dig into the story. We got the background. We know what's going on in Caesarea Philippi. And I'm just going to walk through the story with us here today. So Jesus then arrives into this area. Let's say he's up on this little lofty perch with his disciples. Who knows? Somewhere in the neighborhood. Anyway, he's around in this area. And he asks his opening question of his band of 12. Who do the people say the Son of Man is? Right? Interesting title. Son of Man. When you read the Gospels, you discover that, except for John's Gospel, which is a little bit different, but when you read through the other Gospels, you discover that it seemed to be a favorite title of Jesus in describing Himself. Son of Man, this title appears 103 times. And it's one of those titles, clearly, that seem to be progressive in its development over time, right? It appears in the prophets, it begins to grow. And what we know from the intertestamental period, which is the period of writings in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's a period of about 400 years that existed there, right? And there's a whole bunch of writing that took place during that series. The Catholics have that in their Bible, right? It's called the Apocrypha, or portions of it anyways, in their Bible. We choose not to, for reasons which we won't go into here today, big reasons. But nonetheless, during that Apocrypha period was when the title Son of Man really began to develop and began to be in great use. And so it's interesting then that Jesus, when he comes onto the scene, having followed that great length of history, that it's one of his favorite titles. And it means many things. It certainly means that he was a heavenly person. It connotates his eternal nature, his righteousness, his holiness. He's the one that rules and judges. All these ideas are wrapped up in this Son of Man title. One of the things that it connotates as well, though, is it points towards someone of an earthly nature, right? It points towards that Son of Man. You want to add anything? You should talk to me about Son of Man during the break. You want to add anything about that? Or? No, I got it. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder, but...
Water.
I didn't, yeah, living water. It's actually not. This is still water, right? We'll talk about living water citywide. Okay. So as Sig has talked about here, and as I talked about, Jesus says, so who do people say that the Son of Man is? And it seems like, you know, the lot of them chime in, and they all say, well, some say John the Baptist, and some say Elijah. And some say he's Jeremiah, or he's another great prophet like this. Now, what's the deal with these three terms? In fact, when I was in Israel, our teacher that was with us said, you know, if this is what people were thinking of Jesus and what they thought he was, then maybe it'd be a good idea for us to do a good study of these people, because we might in that get a good understanding of what they saw Jesus to be, right? John the Baptist, Elijah, and Jeremiah, or one of the other great prophets. So what's the deal with John the Baptist to begin with? Well, Herod Antipas, right, had you know, a little bit before, killed John the Baptist. John the Baptist was this huge figure. He dominated the landscape, and actually, for many years, he had a far greater profile than Jesus himself. Thousands were heading out to the desert to be baptized by John the Baptist. He was really a big deal in his time, right? But Antipas obviously doesn't, well, there's a big story there, but in the end of it all, John the Baptist's head shows up at a party at one of Antipas's, you know, big gatherings that he has. But the rumor began to go around that John the Baptist had come back to life, right? And in fact, in Matthew chapter 14, you see Herod the Tetrarch, Herod Antipas, talking about this in very self. At the time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus, and he said to his attendants, "This is John the Baptist, he's risen from the dead. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him." So some people then felt that Jesus was just John the Baptist and he's come back to life. That's what some of the people were saying. Second title that the guys give is that, well, he must be Elijah. Now, by this point in history, we talked about this last week a fair bit, and I'll go into it a little bit here again today. By this point in Israel history, you know, to put it mildly, Israel was like with Messiah. People were going crazy about the Messiah. They were all the Messiah to come, and the reason why they were wanting the Messiah to come was because they hated Rome so much, and they wanted Rome gone. They had Rome up to here. They couldn't stand Rome anymore. And they knew from their Hebrew Bible that one day a Messiah would come and establish the kingdom of Israel as a strong and mighty kingdom where God's people would reign. And so they're like, now is the time for the Messiah. We've had enough of Rome. Can't stand Rome. We need to get rid of Rome. And so the country was becoming overrun with Messiah. I said this last week, but at the time of Jesus, there was at least reports of at least 10 or maybe even more people that rode into Jerusalem pretending or thinking that they were the Messiah as well. People everywhere were talking Messiah. A few of the groups that were interested or that were doing Messiah stuff, interesting at the time, okay, or that were really crazy about Messiah. First group over here, this was their fortress. This is a place called Gamla. And Gamla was the headquarters of a group of people called the Zealots. This over here, you can see a mountain ridge over back in here, maybe just a little bit of a faint picture of a mountain ridge. And over here, you see the one in the foreground. In between there is Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, right? So this is pretty close to the Sea of Galilee. The Zealots chose this location, this outcropping of rock, because they felt like it looked like a fist raised toward Rome. The Zealots were Jews. They were crazy about the Messiah, and they felt that the way that the Messiah, they could invoke the Messiah, come back was by joining him in overthrowing Rome, because obviously that's what the Messiah was about, right? So they began to feel like it was appropriate for them to start killing people, Roman officials and members of the Sanhedrin and the Sadducees at the time. They carried around these knives. They were called the Sicarii knives. And they'd come up behind Roman officials in Jerusalem. They'd head down into Rome. They'd come officials walk up behind them, quietly reach under the cloaks and underneath their chest and drop them down and kill them. The Zealots were the terrorists of the day. And in the end, in 70 AD, why Rome comes in to wipe out Israel, because they can't stand Israel themselves, why they come to wipe out is because they hate the Zealots. Because they're killing all their people. It's interesting. Jesus and his little band of disciples, two of them are zealots. Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot. Iscariot means of the Sicarii. What's that say to you about Jesus? Chooses the zealots? Really? Okay. Other group of people, they were a little bit different. These are the Essenes down the south. They were down by the Dead Sea. Dead Sea is often here. Gray, you can't see it. But this was the south of Israel, the Negev Desert. And they took a prophecy from Isaiah that was like, you know, go out into the desert, make straight the ways of the Lord in the desert. And their idea was that if they were to go out into the desert and really focus on being really holy and really pure, that the God would see that and the Messiah would come and establish the kingdom of Israel. Right? So, So they went into the desert. And how did they make themselves holy? Well, they did all sorts of rituals, but the key thing that they did was they focused on the Torah, the Word of God. And they started to write and write and write and write and scribe and scribe and scribe the Word of God. When Rome came through 70 AD to wipe them all out, they're like, the Word of God, it's so sacred. We can't just leave this around. So what do? They store it in pots, clay pots. And all over this area, we climbed in many of them, all over this area, there are all these cliffs, all these caves built that are you know, eroded out of the rock. 1948, a little Bedouin shepherd's walking through the desert. He loses one of his sheep. He goes like a shepherd to retrieve the lost sheep. And he starts firing stones into all of these caves. All of a sudden, clank, here's something break. What's that? He heads over, explores into the cave. In there, he discovers these pots filled with scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The most significant find in biblical archaeology ever. 1948. Yeah.
The year Israel was born.
Sure.
And the archaeology
started
there. Started with that.
Yeah.
I mean, sort of.
No, it's good. Pam, I like you. You're just right on top of things.
Right on top.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Right next to the Dead Sea. Do you know, anybody know who an Essene was? John the Baptist, they think. There's a good case for him being an Essene. He went out into the desert. He wore their garments. Yeah. Wanted to be pure. And the idea for them was, well, we'll bring back the Messiah. So Israel then, in Jerusalem, is like great, the Messiah. In fact, I commented about this last week, but, you know, even after Jesus dies and rises again, right? He's about to send them off in Acts chapter 1. What's the one question they have for Jesus? Is now the time you're going to establish the kingdom of Israel? Now? No? No.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but when you ride him on a donkey and away from the palm branches, and you basically said that you only knew, like, I think you declared that you did not have the ability.
Hey, you're stealing my thunder! It's good. That's my next slide.
Okay.
No, good. Go for it. Talk about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You'll see the slide in a second. It's okay, Henry. Okay, so now how does this all tie in with Elijah about this Messiah talk? Well, the Israelite people knew that before the Messiah came back, scriptures prophesied that one like Elijah would come before him to make the way for the coming of the Messiah, right? So people were like, ah, Messiah, Messiah, Messiah. And they're thinking, Jesus clearly must be Elijah making the way for the Messiah. Okay, then the other comment they give us is, well, then he was maybe like Jeremiah, which was just a great prophet of the day. Clearly then they understood Jesus to be like this significant figure. So Jesus is like, who do people say the Son of Man is? Well, some are saying John the Baptist, like he's come back to life. And some are saying Elijah, because we're crazy about the Messiah. And some are saying, well, he's Jeremiah, clearly a really godly person. But Jesus then looks back in our little location. He looks at them and he says, okay, what about you guys? Right? Who do you say I am? I heard what they all think, but what about you? Who do you think I am? Am I like Pan here in Caesarea Philippi? Am I like him? Am I like Augustus? The temple's here for him too. Am I like Augustus? Am I just, you know, a great ruler? You think I'm going to be great like that? The people got it right? Did they have it right? Am I Elijah? Am I John the Baptist? Am I just Jeremiah? Who do you say I am? Who am I? Who am I? Who am I to you? And I think that's a great question. Who do you say that I am? Who is the Son of Man? Who is the Son of Man to you? Who do you say that Jesus is? Who is he to you? Who is Jesus to you? Because the answer impacts then what you do with him and how you live your life. And that's what we see about Peter that unfolds from there. The answer that Peter gives that has crazy connotations. Because Jesus, the one thing we know for sure about Jesus is that he can't stand it when people confess something about him and yet fail to live it out. He loathes that. It's like, who do you say that I am? And if you say something like what Peter's about to say, then that has crazy impact on how you live. And if you don't live according to that, then what you say about me in the first place is a pile of bull. Right? It is. It's bull. So, Peter. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Saying what?
Whatever it is we confess about God, you know? We're not, if we really believe that God is that real, we would stay true to it, right? But I think a lot of our confession in the church is just because we want to be in the body, you know? And it's before man, it's not before heaven, right?
Interesting. Oh, so you're saying that before men, not in the world, but you're saying men in here?
Yeah, men were. Yeah, I guess. It's like we're not thinking God's real.
No.
Because we can just say anything. And men won't know any different.
And Peter's going to, or Jesus is going to comment on that in a second. So Peter, what's Peter say to the question, right, that Jesus asked? He says, so, are you the Messiah? The Son of the living God. Now, this is not the first time that someone has called him the Messiah, that someone's called him the Christ. But when Peter says it, one thing that comes clear in what Jesus responds is that it delights Jesus. Right? It makes him happy. Wow, Peter, you said this. Clearly it's been received from the Father to you, right? But what's interesting is that when you explore Peter's confession about Christ, one thing that's clear is that it's actually quite loaded. What Peter says about Christ is real loaded. And some of it, I think, is bang on, and some of it, our hindsight, looking back at what he says, we go, well, maybe he was slightly off the mark there. So let's explore a little bit of what Peter says. First of all, he says, you're the Messiah. Now, we just saw lots about the Messiah, right? So when Peter calls him the Messiah, you can be sure it's a pretty loaded interpretation of the Messiah. It's not our understanding of what the Messiah was about. It's Peter and the general understanding of the day of what the Messiah was about. And the land at the time was crazy about the Messiah. Everyone wanted the Messiah, but their Messiah that they wanted was their deliverer, right? Their political, their conquering king, their military revolt guy, the guy that was going to come and establish a physical kingdom of Israel here and now in the present. And maybe there's some truth to that in the long run. These things are still up in the air, I suppose. But for Peter, he had an understanding of the Messiah. And so when Jesus, as Henry talked about here, when Jesus finally enters Jerusalem to be the Messiah, like Peter, everyone's anticipating one understanding of the Messiah, and Jesus then approaches the city of Jerusalem. He rides down the Mount of Olives into the Kidron Valley, and somewhere out in here it says, as he approached Jerusalem and he saw the city, it says that he wept over it, and the words there actually aren't even wept. They're more like he screamed. Like he screamed. He wailed with passion over it, and he said, if you... even you had only known what on this day would be the way to your peace. Now it's hidden from your eyes. You thought your Messiah would be the way to your peace. It's hidden from your eyes now. And no doubt the great military leader, triumphant kingdom of Israel, physical leader is what Peter had in mind when he said this. We can be sure of this. Because right after Peter's confession, Jesus, what's he do? He starts talking about what's going to happen to him. And the Son of Man, after this, the Son of Man is going to go into Jerusalem. Yeah, okay. All right. You're going to establish it. I'm going to actually suffer many things at the hands of men. And they're going to chain me up. And they're going to hang me up on a cross. And Peter, he's like, no. What are you talking about? You're the Messiah. I just said it. You're the Messiah. I confess it. I believe it. You're the Messiah. You're going to Jerusalem. You're doing it. Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. Right now, Peter, you may have got the first right in some way, but right now you're thinking the thoughts of men and not the thoughts of God. And you know what? I can't fault Peter. I got to be honest with you. Everyone in this room would have thought the same thing about Jesus in that day. We all would have. Peter's interpretation of the Messiah would have been ours today. And the fact of the matter is that today, when Jesus asks us this question, who do you say that I am? Our interpretation might not be screwed up about the Messiah thing, though it could be. But our interpretation about who Jesus is and the answer to that is screwed up all the time. Who do you say that I am? Oh, when I ask you that question, how many of you are saying, you're the righteous warrior judge who hates sin with fire in his eyes? How many of you, is that your interpretation? But it's true. I can guarantee you, for most of you, when I ask you, who do you say Jesus is, your interpretation is? Well, he's the God of love and kindness and gentleness and peace and compassion. And it's all true. But so often our interpretation of Jesus and the answer to this question, who do you say I am, is like Peter's, a little off the mark. Or a little oriented toward what we want him to be. And so maybe actually, not that I'm trying to rewrite Jesus' questions here, but maybe actually the better question that we need to think about is, who does Jesus say he is? Because that's the Jesus that he intends for us to worship. Not our Jesus. His Jesus. Who does Jesus say he is? Okay, so the first thing he says is he's the Messiah. Next thing he says, well, and you're the Son of the living God. Now, that's an interesting contrast, right? Because Jesus asked him in the first place, who do people say the Son of Man is? And Peter replies, well, you're the Son of the living God, right? Son of God. Now, the Son of God was another one of these great, significant terms. And it clearly pointed towards, you know, the divine nature of God. It was born from David, and as it progressed over time, because David was called the initial son of God, right? And Jesus coming from his line, it progressed from there and developed in there, clearly pointing to the divine nature of God. But what's interesting about this is that in Matthew, anyway, Jesus never called himself the Son of God at this point. He never called himself the Son of God. The angels announced him as coming as the Son of God. When Jesus wrestled with Satan out in the temptation, Satan's term for Jesus the whole time through was the Son of God. The demons, when Jesus was kicking them out, they called him the Son of God in many places. Crowds worshiping him and said in places, he's the Son of God. In the end, Caiaphas asks him, are you the Son of God? But Jesus doesn't take the term for himself, but here clearly it delights him. Right, because he looks at Peter and says, ah, you got it. And this was given to you by the Father. Clearly the Father's been speaking to you and you've been listening. And for Jesus, we know the one thing that was clear about Jesus is that everything was oriented around the Father. He was always wanting to do the Father's will. So now that he sees one of his proteges is getting it from the Father, like, wow, you're learning. It's about the Father. It's about the glory of the Father, right? So he's excited about this, you know, in this land. He's like, where no one else is getting it, in this place, Caesarea Philippi, where everybody's worshiping Pan.
in this land where people think I'm Elijah, where they think I'm John the Baptist. You get it, Peter. I'm the Son of God. But he adds something in there, right? Third thing he says is he's the Son of the living God. Now this is interesting. I think it's kind of special. If it hasn't been special already, I think this is special. So he says, you're the Son of the living God. And what makes this so special is because Pan, who was worshipped in Caesarea Philippi, is the only Greek god to have died. He died. And when does history record that he died in Greek mythology? History records that Pan died during the reign of Emperor Tiberius during the time of AD 14 to AD 37. Who was ministering and working in the time of AD 14 to 37? Jesus, right? Jesus. So when Jesus was ministering, Pan dies. A Greek historian, Mark, writes this about the journey of Pan. Plutarch recorded, the news of Pan's death came to Thamus, a sailor on his way to Italy by the island of Paxi. A divine voice hailed him across the salt water. Thamus, are you there? When you reach Pilatus, take care to proclaim that the great god Pan is dead. Which Thamus did, and the news was greeted from the shore with groans and lament. Now I want you to imagine the scene here again. Everybody here on this is going crazy about Pan. They're still worshiping him. Jesus is looking over this. The worship is still going on. It went on for a few hundred years after Jesus departs. It's all toward Pan. And Peter says, Jesus, you're the Son of the living God. Pan is dead. I got it. Pan is dead. But you are the Son of the living God. And I think the application to that, right, is like so good, so straightforward, because here we are. We might not be in open air Pan like they are, but nonetheless, we live in our own Panis. Right? All the temples, all the various stuff going on, all the different idols in our own lives, and all the while, there's like a big white elephant. There's a big secret in the world. It's all dead. It doesn't lead to anything. A god of money. A god of sex. A god of power. It's all dead. But Jesus is the living God. And he stands and he wants us to acknowledge him as the living God in our world, like Peter. In our panis, he wants us to stand up and say, do you believe that I'm the living God? And guys, in our world today, we must be willing to stand and say, he is the living God. He is the living God. We can't slink into the background, sheepishly kind of creating a Jesus into our own image. And amidst everything that's going on around us, we can't pretend that he's not really ours in the world and yet then come together with God's people and say, oh, Messiah, God, good. Jesus is asking us in our panias, who do you say that I am? And we need to be able unashamedly to say, oh, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, if we're not, he says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, this is what he says at the end of the passage, if anyone is ashamed of me in this adulterous and sinful generation here in Panias, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels. Now that is harsh. Now that's just straight up Jesus. That's not cute, cuddly Jesus. That's Jesus getting in our face in the middle of Panias and saying, are you ashamed of this fact? Now, it doesn't mean that we're obnoxious dorks about the proclamation of Jesus, right? Or what we feel about him. But on the other hand, it also means that we're not sheepishly pretending that he's not really our God.
again, we come to this question. Who in this world do you say that Jesus is? Is he the Messiah, the Son of the living God to you? And are you ashamed of that fact? And Jesus, I just pray for my friends here and for friends that aren't with us tonight. I first of all just pray for a release of guilt on areas where we have been ashamed of you. Frankly, all of us could answer that question, yes. We're all ashamed of you. Especially in our world where it seems like everywhere we go, people aren't too crazy about you. And so forgive us, gracious Lord, for where we're ashamed. And on the other hand, we pray for your Spirit to equip us to make known in our panias that you're the Son of the living God, you're the Messiah, and we believe it to be true unashamedly. So bless our friends. Okay. A little bit more. And this is neat here, this next little section. So, Jesus is obviously like, he's really pleased with what the Father has done in Peter. And what's he do? But he blesses him. This is a picture taken from that plateau, from the rock looking out over. You can see what the region's like. And while we were sitting there, these Jacob ladders kind of started to coming through the clouds. And I was like, wow. Just remind, every time I see Jacob's ladder, I don't know, maybe you're like me or whatever, I just kind of think, wow, presence of God, you know, blessing of God. And Jesus, when Peter gets it right, he blesses him. Right? Blesses him. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. You got it right. He changes his name from Simon, which God does often to people throughout Scripture, Jacob to Israel, to signify something new that's happening in them, right? He changes his name from Simon to Peter, right? And for the first time ever, he then announces, you are Peter, and upon you, I'm going to build my church. This is the first time he talks about this thing called the church. Now, this is kind of where it gets interesting. Anybody know what Peter means? Rock. You got that right. Okay, good. The word for Peter is Petros. It's the masculine because Peter was a male, so they chose the masculine Petros to describe Peter, which means rock. So Jesus says, basically, in effect, though we translate it into Peter, what Jesus actually said to him was, you are rock, and upon this rock, I'll build my church. What's interesting, though, is that the second word that he uses for rock is actually Petra, and it's the feminine version. And the feminine has a broader scope of meaning. The feminine means, here's a little picture of a lexicon for you. The feminine means a rock, a cliff, or a ledge, a projecting rock, a crag, a rocky ground. And the further down you see the for like a man, like a rock. So put this together here then. Where is Jesus standing with people, right? Where is he standing? In fact, do I have a picture of it here? Yes. Where is he standing? He's standing on the rock where all this temple was taking place. So what's he saying? He's saying, you are Petros, and upon this Petra I will build my church. What's he meaning with that? What's he meaning? Well, one thing we can know for sure is that he was definitely meaning upon Peter the person he's going to build his church. We can't take that away from it. Just because the words change, clearly he's talking about, yeah, upon you, Peter, who I'm just changing the name rock, upon you, the rock, I'm going to build my church. And the reason why we can be so certain about that is because then Jesus right away, he follows it up and he says, and here's the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Right? So then he blesses them with authority to actually build the church and be a part of the building of the God. Right? So it's like clearly Jesus has in mind, you are Peter, and upon you and upon your confession and what you're communicating here today, I will build my church. And here's the authority to do it.
But the thing is that Jesus was always speaking in double meanings, right? He often spoke in riddles, and this is clearly for me one of those places where a double meaning is taking place. Because he's like, upon you, Peter, I'm going to build my church, but also upon Petra, upon this rock, I'll build my church. Upon Panias, upon places like this, this is where my church is going to be built. It's here in these places. So coming back to this, I think without question, Jesus brought them, and one of the reasons why he brought them to Caesarea Philippi was to blow their paradigms. Right? These were all good Jewish boys. And they understood from all that had been passed on to them that God didn't work in places like this. God worked in the people of God, with the people of God, with the nation of Israel. That's where God worked. But here Jesus is saying, guys, I want you to understand something. That in this world, on this rock, where Pan is being worshipped, and on you, Peter, it's here I'm building my church. It's in Panias I'm building my church. See, I came not because the health the doctor, but because the sick needed one. So if you want to be where I'm at, then you need to understand that you're going to be spending time in Panias. And you need to get over all your religious stuff, because this is where I'm building my church. He's building his church on Panias, on this rock. Now, what's that mean for us? Right? What's that mean for us? Where's Jesus building his church in Vancouver? Where's Jesus at work in Vancouver? Remember what Panias was like. That was hell. That's where Jesus is building his church. Well, that's pretty crazy, isn't it? Gets better. Even more promising. Because then Jesus adds this. And the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. Now, sometimes this term is translated hell. The NIV here is your Bibles, you got it right. It's actually, it is Hades. The gates of Hades. History, you know, throughout history, Hades eventually became to be known as hell. By our understanding, we understand Hades to be hell. But in that time, Hades had a very different meaning, or at least, again, a broader meaning. Here's back to our little lexicon. Hades. Hades, the name, was also the name of another Greek god, Hades or Pluto, who was the god of the lower regions, the netherworld, the realm of the dead. This was Hades. It was the netherworld. Now, that's interesting, the netherworld. Because remember back to the grotto. It was believed that at the bottom of that grotto was where Pan chose to live. And Pan was a member of the netherworld. It was understood that at the bottom of that grotto was Hades, the netherworld. And in Jesus' day, history records that the people in Panias called that grotto the entrance to, or the gates to, Hades. Now that's cool. The gates of Hades. So put it together. What he just said to Peter. These things, they haven't been revealed to you by man. They've been revealed to you by my Father in heaven. And you are Peter. And on you, this rock now, I'm going to build my church, and here's the kingdom. Here's the authority by which you're going to do it. But you need to understand, it's not just going to happen in your little comfortable world. It's going to be happening here in Panias. Unless you be really afraid of what Panias is all about and all the things that are going on around with Panias, don't fear, because the gates of Hades, the gates of this netherworld, and all this stuff that's going on, he'll not triumph over you. The gates of Hades won't prevail. All this stuff isn't going to prevail. But the church will prevail. The church that I'm building will prevail. See, Jesus brought them to Caesarea Philippi to remind them that the things of this world will not win. And I think that's so good. Because we look around and we look at places like the downtown East Side. You know, we look at single moms in our church and all the stuff that's going on. And we look at all the ways that Panias is working itself out today in our culture. And it can seem really hopeless, can't it? But Jesus is saying, no. They won't win. And the implicit message in all of this, right? That we know, we've talked about this before, at least some of us have, is that gates are not offensive things. In cities, they're defensive things. They're intended to keep people in. And so the idea there that Jesus is actually communicating is that the church will storm the gates of Hades. And we're not going to be sitting back and seeing a world of hell and a world of bull decaying itself. We're going to be storming the gates of Hades. And I think that says a lot about each of your churches and about the mission you're engaging in. You're not sitting around in holy huddles, you guys. You're engaging the world head on. Be thinking about mission. Be thinking about storming the gates. Don't sit around in your houses. Now, it's important to sit around in your houses. But don't stop there. Do the work of engaging in the world, personally in your life, relationally, but also as churches. Okay. One brief little comment, and then we're finished. So, Jesus affirms then, quite the morning, Jesus affirms what he's doing in Peter, blesses him, discloses his plan. But he has one more thing that he needs to offer as the time kind of wraps up. He gathers his disciples together, and Mark indicates here, oh, there's your gates of Hades again, sorry, not keeping up with my slides. Ah, yes. So he gathers his disciples together, and Mark's gospel actually includes that it wasn't just the disciples here, that it was also the crowds, and he says something to this effect. Now, you guys like this? You like the sounds of this? You're feeling kind of triumphalistic? Great, Church of God, it's going to expand, right? And the gates of hell are not going to prevail against it. You like this? The sounds kind of goes along with the Messiah thing. You like this? This sounds good? Okay, so here's what you need to understand next. That if you come after me and if you follow me, then prepare for this one thing. You're going to suffer. This is going to be hard. You're going to pick up your cross. Those things that you've seen thousands of them in your lifetime, people hanging on them. Herod's great display of power over the criminal. You're going to pick one of those things up and you're going to follow me. This is an olive tree. And I kind of like the image of the olive tree after being in Israel, because in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus sweat blood, it was an olive grove, right? And the idea there that was going on was that like an olive being pressed out of its oil, Jesus was being pressed out, and he was being pressed down so much that he, in the end, sweat blood. Right. See you guys. Thank you for coming. Yeah. He sweat blood. And this is what Jesus is inviting us to. The olive tree being pressed down. Like, if you want to preserve your life here, guys, if you want to live for all of this, if you want to live for Panias, then fine. Go ahead. But in the end, you're going to lose your life. But if you want to live for me, then great. But you need to know that it's going to involve great amounts of suffering. And in the end, though, you're going to find that actually it's there that you receive life. It's in the midst of the suffering that you receive life and the blessing of God. And I think finally that Jesus brought them to Caesarea Philippi because he wanted them to be clear about this one thing. That his kingdom had nothing to do with the pursuits of Caesarea Philippi. He was doing something completely different. And it was all for the surpassing glory of knowing Jesus and for building the church. Right? And building his kingdom. And that's what Jesus has called us into. And I'd leave it like a really rah-rah happy ending. But Jesus, his next scene, he starts to make his way to Jerusalem to suffer, to actually live it out. So I think it's kind of good for us to leave it on the suffering thing. Because that's where Jesus left it, with these guys. Their graduation message is what it was. Jesus moved on from Jerusalem to there. And that's Jesus' visit to Caesarea Philippi. Any questions? Comments? Thoughts? Application? Well, Caesarea Philippi is different than Philippi. But you're wondering, was it where the... No, because he said, no, I don't think so. I mean, the first church was in Jerusalem. Either. That's the nice thing about hindsight. Hindsight's 20/20.